Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Scott Kennedy, the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships, and his latest book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Kennedy.
Thanks so much.
And in retaliation to the $200 billion of duties that U.S. just slapped on Chinese imports on Monday, Beijing has responded with $60 billion trade tariffs on American goods. They've spared rare earths, which, of course, are key to the tech industry. Where is this tit-for-tat exchange heading?
It looks like by the end of the year or early next year, the U.S. and China will have extra tariffs on just about everything that we trade with each other. In addition, the U.S. is drawing up the drawbridge on Chinese investment in the United States, perhaps increased export controls, and the Chinese are going to retaliate with their own types of restraints on American investment and making life more difficult for us. And then we're looking beyond the economic space as well to compete more on the strategic front and other areas if we continue down the path that the Trump administration has set us on.
So at his press conference today with the Polish Prime Minister at the White House, President Trump went on at length about what a great relationship he has with President Xi, who's a friend of mine, he says, but they've been taking advantage of us. And, you know, last year we lost over $500 billion in China. We're not going to do that anymore. I think he actually said, I'm looking through the White House transcript, I think he actually said that the Chinese economy or the stock market is down 30%. So he was sort of boasting that we're already putting the screws to China. What's the real situation there?
All of the points that he just mentioned, save for the trends in the stock market, don't bear any resemblance to reality. Certainly Xi Jinping and he have a cordial relationship, but they're friends in the way that I'm friends with someone on the other side of the world who I see once every blue moon, who I barely know. And so that's not a relationship that they can depend on. And certainly China's economy is slowed a little bit, but its financial markets are down somewhat more. But overall, China's economy is riding out this trade war basically without suffering very much at all. And the chances that China is going to cry uncle very soon because of these tariffs is really a pipe dream. And of course, the Chinese are also mistaken that the Trump administration is going to stop. So we've got two sides that both think they have leverage over the other that are going to keep pushing ahead.
So as you know, surely, Scott, President Trump is not popular with more than half of the country. His popularity is down a little bit below 40% at the moment, but he has a core support. But he's also under siege in various directions. You know, his personal lawyer has pleaded guilty. His former campaign manager has pleaded guilty. His former deputy campaign manager has pleaded guilty. One of his foreign policy advisors has pleaded guilty. And his first national security advisor has pleaded guilty. So how does that look abroad? Do the Chinese think maybe we can ride this thing out? This guy's not going to last very long.
Certainly the Chinese don't want to make a lot of concessions, and they have hoped from the beginning that Trump was a deal maker and would take a quick deal that let China off the hook in exchange for just importing a few more goods from the United States. That obviously didn't get them very far, and they got the tariffs instead, and now they're hoping for those investigations to pan out or the Republicans to lose the midterms or for the U.S. stock market to collapse. For impeachment to go forward or something like that. That's really not a very sound approach that a country should take toward foreign policy, engaging with the United States, one of their largest economic partners and strategically very important for China. And of course, those things could go wrong, but the president has had these views on China for 30-plus years, and he's got advisors in the security space and in the White House who have strong views on China as well. So they are not just going to turn and ease up on China because they've got problems, political problems in the United States.
Yeah, but the views of people like Peter Navarro, they're strong views, but they're completely erroneous.
Oh, I'm not disagreeing with you, but you know, the both Beijing and the Trump administration are going to continue to push ahead. Regardless of whether they're right or wrong, there are other ways to try and deal with the China problem. I mean, I guess you could say at least the Trump administration's heart is in the right place. They do recognize that we have serious difficulties with the Chinese that patient negotiation hadn't resolved, and we needed to do more. But the approach that they're taking is likely going to make things worse rather than better.
Well, in terms of the big bust that happened in Singapore, the big photo op that's delivered very little, already we're learning now that China and Russia are basically secretly trading with North Korea. So that leverage is gone. But I just wonder in general what the attitudes are in China. I was looking at recently at a piece that former State Department official who does psychological profiles on world leaders for the State Department. He sent me a piece from China by Professor Xu Zhangrun, a monograph called Imminent Fears, Immediate Hopes, which has apparently been widely circulated in academic circles in China. He doesn't spare, he's also critical, Xu is critical of Xi, but he lambasts President Trump. And just a quote from this prominent Chinese academic, describing Trump as a personality amplified by bloated self-regard and a lifetime habit of rapaciousness. The result is a person possessed of a prideful quasi-imperial mindset that is coupled to heinous vulgarity, a kind of shyster who boastfully promotes themselves while sullying everything in the guise of loyalty, dealing with new problems within the framework of an out-of-touch mindset, while nonetheless exuding supreme confidence. He inevitably makes the mistakes of the willful. That's a pretty, I mean, frankly, I agree with it, but it's a pretty powerful rebuke, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. It sounds like this person's spending a lot of time watching MSNBC and reading a lot about the president from the American popular media. And I think all of us, because have become part-time psychologists, because the president is so out there in social media every single day and is such a character. And I can't say that, you know, all those things are wrong. That doesn't necessarily mean that what China is doing is right or that everything that the president says is inaccurate about China. There's a lot of truth to the idea that China is really stepped on the gas in terms of government intervention in the domestic economy and society. Just look what it's doing in Xinjiang with Muslims there and internationally being much more aggressive. And patient diplomacy wasn't really effective in constraining them, and that more needs to be done. The U.S. just needs to be much better organized about it and do a much better job of working with allies, both through international institutions like the WTO, through creating new institutions like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and then where needed, using, you know, its sharp elbows and other things to, you know, let the Chinese know that they really need to follow international best practices if they want to interact with us in a way that's beneficial to them. So I think that, yes, you can go through all of the psychological analysis that you want, but at the end of the day, this is going to be about hard-headed decisions about policy, not armchair quarterbacking on, you know, the psychologist's couch.
Well, let's look at China as a rising power and the United States in terms of being able to check this power and encourage a more liberal path, which the Chinese under Xi have definitely not taken. They've done the reverse. Yeah. My understanding from China scholars I talked to is that the U.S. immediately dropped the ball when Trump arrived and immediately got rid of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was a way to organize the entire neighborhood to force China to play by our rules as opposed to be an outlier. You've also got this possibility of China and Russia forming some kind of an alliance. They're traditional rivals or even occasional enemies. But the job of U.S. diplomacy in this situation vis-a-vis China and this kind of revanchist militarism and nationalism that Xi is bringing about requires some diplomatic skill. I don't see it. In fact, when your rivals are uniting against you, I mean, going back to Nixon, he was able to put the U.S. in the catbird seat to play China off against Russia. The reverse seems to be happening now.
Yes, yes. I would agree that we've got a lot of ham-fisted diplomacy emanating from Washington that weakens U.S. influence around the world. I don't think that we should go too far, though, in saying that everything was fine up until the president came into office. TPP was a great idea. The Obama administration negotiated the final text, but it didn't do what was necessary to get it adopted by Congress. And so the establishment of both the Democratic and Republican parties let it not get passed and put into law before Trump arrived. And that's their fault. Trump just hammered the last nail in the coffin on TPP. He didn't really stop it at the beginning. And remember, Hillary Clinton was opposed to TPP when she was candidate. But so there's a lot of blame to go around. Luckily, the U.S. is still a very strong nation. We are a very innovative nation. We're very resourceful. I live and work in Washington, D.C., but I know that the rest of the country, including where you are, is quite vibrant and creative. And that if we would just let Washington, if we could just fix some of the things that we're doing here, a lot of the optimism and skills and creativity that are demonstrated every day around the United States would dominate, and we wouldn't feel so pessimistic and gloomy all the time.
So since you mentioned me being out here in California, Scott, I'm literally talking to you from across the street from Universal Studios in La La Land. What's extraordinary about what's going on in China in terms of show business, China's most popular actress has simply disappeared. And, you know, that would be like Jennifer Lawrence winning the Academy Award and then disappearing and nobody knows what happened to her. Do you have any insight into what might have happened to Fan?
I have absolutely no idea other than being able to speculate that she was detained because of potential problems with her taxes. Personal income taxes are a very small part of overall tax receipts in China, but they're a growing part, and those who are wealthy pay a lot more than those who are a working class, which is most of China. And one has to, fear for the worst for her in a place where the police and other elements of the state use very hard-nosed tactics against people who they've deemed to have done something that is either, you know, technically illegal or somehow otherwise run afoul of the interests of the party state. I think eventually we will know. There's been other people from who are actors and popular figures in China from business who have disappeared to eventually reappear, often in court as defendants in a trial. And so I think most likely we'll eventually get some insight into this. I think the likelihood of this turning out well for her is pretty low.
But it does remind you that it is a totalitarian state, right? That for all of the advertising on television and full-page ads in the Times about how great things are in China, for the average citizen, they don't have a lot of power and a lot of rights.
Yeah, I mean, this is relatively quite rare for people. And if you go about your normal daily life, you have a lot of personal private freedom. You can travel typically. But yes, the walls of the party state in China, when you bump into them, they push back very hard. And certainly that's expanded under Xi Jinping, not just for ethnic minorities in Western China, but others. And your ability to push back is extremely small once they've decided that you're
enemy of the state. Like.
Yes.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Scott Kennedy. I appreciate it.
Good talking with you.
Thank you. And again, I'm speaking with Scott Kennedy. He's the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships. And his latest book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.